Welcome to Siyasa, a podcast on Middle East policy and politics. Today, we're going to discuss the U.S.-Iranian negotiations and their possible implications on the region. My guest is Dr. Vali Nasser, and I'm Ibrahim Alassi.
In 2018, President Trump withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, which was negotiated by the Obama administration for years and signed in 2015. The agreement also included the other four members of the United Nations Security Council, China, Russia, France, and the UK, plus Germany. However, the deal drew significant criticism in the United States and the Middle East. Republicans opposed the agreement, citing its limitations on blocking Iran from reaching a nuclear bomb in the long term. In the Middle East, most Gulf countries and Israel described the deal as weak and that it failed in dealing with the Iranian ballistic missile program and its support of armed militias across the region. When Biden entered the White House in January of this year, he launched indirect talks with the Iranians, who also had elections in May, and the new president, Ibrahim Raisi, assumed office in August. Today, it's unclear if those negotiations will revive the old agreement, reach a new deal, or just collapse. To discuss not only the U.S. policy towards Iran, but also the regional dynamics and possible implications, I'm joined by one of the most knowledgeable experts on the Middle East, Professor Vali Nasser. A scholar and political scientist, Nasser is a professor of international affairs and Middle East studies at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS. And he served as the 8th dean of the school between 2012 and 2019. He has advised senior American policymakers and world leaders, and was described by The Economist as a leading world authority on Shia Islam.
Professor Nasser, I'm really, really glad to have you on this very first episode of the podcast. And there is no way we can find somebody better than you to start talking about the Middle East and the U.S.-Iranian relationships. And then we dive in more into some of the regional dynamics that are taking place in the Middle East. Let me start by asking you about the first 3 months of Ibrahim Raisi's term. What do we make of those 3 months? The Supreme Leader clearly cleared the way for Raisi to become the president. So clearly there is an agenda, there is a plan. The United States is keen on, or the Biden administration at this point, is keen on rejoining the nuclear agreement after the previous President Trump unilaterally left the agreement. How do you read the first 3 months of the term of Ibrahim Raisi?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast. It's very good to be with you on this event. The priority for the new president in Iran has been obviously to settle in the job. So I think has to deal with the economy in Iran, with the COVID crisis, with a lot of the political issues and economic issues that he promised he would fix. Mm-hmm. So I think that has been his priority first and foremost. But he did put together a foreign policy team who are much more conservative and I would say hardline and perhaps closer to the views of the security establishment in Iran. Mm-hmm. The priority that Mr. Raisi put himself is that he would focus on Iran's regional relations, because that's actually where most of Iran's trade has been happening. Mm. And also on relations with China. And he reiterated that Iran is keen to build a strategic partnership with China. On the nuclear issue, Iran argued that it actually has to reassess the Rouhani administration's approach to the talk. It has to see where they stand. It has to identify a new negotiating team. Mm. And in reality, these were serious debates within the conservative camp. How much of the old negotiating team should stay in place, how they should approach the nuclear talks, both in terms of getting better results in their view than Rouhani got, but also they could not just basically come back to the talks as if there's no new political administration in Iran. Even domestically, they had to distinguish themselves from the Rouhani administration. Mm. And also they took some, I think, degree of temperature gauging with Europeans, with Chinese, with Russians, having their own conversations in New York, on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly, in meetings in Brussels, in Tehran, as well as traveling to Moscow, Beijing, etc.
Mm.
So eventually they came back with the view that they want to come back to the talks. Maybe later in November 2021, they would resume the talks, that they still are interested in a deal that would lift sanctions on Iran, would Iran would go back to full compliance. But they've also put the onus on the United States to be serious about lifting of the sanctions and wanting to come back into the deal.
Right.
So I think, you know, they haven't reversed course. They're staying on the same course. They claim to have a plan that would make Iran's foreign policy more effective than it was pursued by the previous administration.
Right. And to your point on the Iranian plan probably to focus more on regional trade and also to find an alternative with China. We saw how it became a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September. But many analysts are really skeptical that Iran could work on its economy, or Ibrahim Raisi could deliver some of its economic promises that he promised during his elections, during the campaign, without lifting the sanctions. Do you think that if actually the negotiations were to stop or not to reach a real result between the United States and Iran, that Raisi could deliver any economic reforms or improvement domestically in Iran? Or you think it's really linked and correlated to the negotiations with the United States to be able to improve the Iranian economy?
I mean, there's no doubt that Iran's economy is suffering. It hasn't collapsed, as President Trump or Secretary Pompeo perhaps had assumed and hoped.
Mm.
It hasn't collapsed. So it's functioning, but it's not functioning very well. There is poverty in Iran. There is popular frustration. The government has difficulty meeting social needs, but it also has increasingly difficulty sustaining infrastructure in Iran, which requires investment in upkeep of varieties of infrastructure, electricity, gas, water, healthcare, et cetera.
Mm.
So I think that Iran is very motivated to get a deal. I don't think the Iranians are convinced that the United States wants a deal, and therefore some just as the United States tries to put the burden on Iran, saying, oh, well, we're ready to have a deal. It's the Iranians who don't want a deal. They may not come back to Vienna. If they come, they're not ready to compromise. The Iranians are also saying the same things, that we are ready to come back, but it's the United States that is dragging its feet, or is not willing to lift sanctions for real.
Mm.
And I think this is partly for consumption of the international community, but it's also for consumption of the Iranian public. I think you're right, Mr. Raisi definitely needs a better economy in order to make this conservative takeover of power in Iran to hold.
Mm.
And majority of Iranians are looking for economic delivery on a daily basis in their lives. The higher politics of cultural opening, political opening, better relations with the West, etc. Those are all very important to them. But daily bread and butter issues are even more important, unemployment, etc. But so Iran is definitely motivated to improve its economy with the deal. But it's not, I think it's not convinced that the United States is going to do what Iran would want it to do to get to a deal. And secondly, they're not willing to get a deal at any price.
Mm.
I mean, that's something that President Trump also found out, that yes, they want to get a deal, but not at the cost of a total, complete surrender to the United States. Or they're not willing to sign a deal for it to be reversed in 2 years' time if there's a new administration in power. Or they're not willing to sign a deal and then leave the door open for the United States to reimpose the same sanctions under a different pretext, or not lift the sanctions because of bureaucratic, lethargy, and Iran goes back into full compliance within 3 months, and U.S. is still working on lifting sanctions 2 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So, so they're not willing to make those kinds of deals. But I think the key issue that you raised, that are they motivated to get a deal, which is what the United States has to work with, is yes, they are motivated to get a deal.
Very important point. So what I heard from you, that both sides are clearly interested in going back, or having, whether going back to the old deal or having a new deal, because also from the American side, there is that scrutiny now on the sunset clause, and which might be very also problematic to go back to the same deal, given that most likely President Biden will also face big opposition from the Republicans on the Hill, in both chambers, and probably in other parts of the U.S. government. So my question to you, when Biden became president, he appointed Robert Malley as U.S. special envoy for Iran, and they were clearly trying to send some signals that they are interested, but there is mistrust between both sides. What would your advice be? And you advise a lot of world leaders. Let's see if one or two points for each side. What do you think they should be doing now to get closer to reach a deal? And here we're talking about both the Iranian side and the American side.
Well, I think the parameters of a deal are fairly clear. One is that Iran wants lifting of, Iran ideally wants to go back to 2017 in terms of where the sanctions lifting was.
Mm-hmm.
And also it wants to make sure that the sanctions would not be reimposed at will anytime there's a new president or a change of administration. And the United States wants Iran to go into not only full compliance with the nuclear deal, but also agree to additional set of security measures that addresses not only the sunset clauses that you mentioned, but also perhaps the additional nuclear advancement that Iran has achieved in the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, this is the crux of the negotiations. That's why 90% was agreed on until now. Which is, you take these steps and go back into compliance and we can lift these sanctions. But it's that last mile that's the problem, which is the Iranians want guarantees that if they make serious compromises, that a deal has legs and that they don't tie their economy again to a whim of another president. And that it's very difficult for the Biden administration to provide them with that. Or to give them a guarantee that whatever they agree to, the Congress will actually abide by, or the sanctions would be lifted. And the Iranian side, the difficulty is for Iran to accept that not only would they go back into JCPOA, but they would be willing to accept additional nuclear safeguards. Let's put it that way.
Mm.
I think a whole new deal is difficult, because if you scrap JCPOA completely and you wanted to start from zero, it might take 2-3 years to negotiate another deal completely from scratch.
Right.
So I don't think it's to the advantage of either side to play that game. I think they have to find a formula that allows them to revive and sustain JCPOA and then build on it.
Mm.
Now, the Iranians don't want to commit to this in writing because they're afraid that then that opens the door to the US to reimpose sanctions by saying, oh yes, you're in compliance with the original deal, but the negotiation on the next steps are going too slowly, so we can put the sanctions back. And the United States, for its part, does not want to go back into JCPOA and lift sanctions unless it knows there is a roadmap to something bigger, to the next steps. So they have to, in earnest, arrive at a formula that allows them to have their cake and eat it too. And that's where the crux of diplomacy is.
Hmm.
I mean, most of diplomacy is fairly straightforward in that sense. You know what the two sides want. You can do 90% of it. It's those sort of last critical issues that requires compromise, and it requires innovative way of thinking about how you formulate things that would satisfy both sides.
Very interesting.
And I think that's where things have to be resorted. And then the last part I would say, there is a domestic constituency in both countries. I mean, an Iran deal will invite massive amount of opposition from the same groups that opposed the deal in 2015.
For sure.
And so that I'm sure is in the mind of President Biden as Iranians would ask him for certain compromises. And similarly in Iran, after attacking the deal that Rouhani and Zarif signed and for over 4 or 5 years, I mean, Raisi cannot go back to Iran and say, well, I made even more compromises than those guys did without getting anything for it.
Mm.
So diplomacy does not happen in a foreign policy vacuum. There is a domestic constituency that is in the minds of both leaders on both sides in terms of how they're going to market and defend a deal back home.
Very interesting. And that leads me to talk or to ask you about some of the regional dynamics. While the road for negotiations with the United States seems very rocky, there has been a small opening between Iran and Saudi Arabia. 4 rounds of negotiations took place in the last few months between Iran and Saudi Arabia. There are reports that there might be steps to reopen consulates in Mashhad in Iran and in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. What also do we make of this regional talks? And do you think there is a potential to reach something tangible out of these talks between these two main middle powers in the Middle East, Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I think this is something new and it's important. I know that it's very easy to dismiss that because they've met 3 times and they're not already, become best of friends, that therefore these talks are not going anywhere. But I don't see it that way. I think the glass is definitely half full.
Mm-hmm.
For two countries that have not had embassies for at least 5 years now, 6 years, that have not talked to each other directly at all. The fact that they've had a first meeting and a first meeting led to a second, to a third, to a fourth is progress. It's definitely progress.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things have changed. I think for the Iranian part, despite the pressure they suffered under Trump, they're fairly confident of their position in the Middle East. They hit Saudi oil facilities in 2019, I think, or 2020. Without any retaliation from the U.S. So they think that Saudi Arabia got the message that the Americans are not going to back them.
Mm.
They cannot sort of be at war with Iran indefinitely. The Iranians at the same time are fairly confident with the outcomes in Yemen and Syria that have been in their favor. And they're still standing in Iraq and Lebanon. So their regional footing has not gone down. The Iranians are interested in getting back into sale of oil if the deal with the United States goes through. And so they realize then they need to work with Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus, et cetera. So they need to resolve that. And I think also the Iranians very well understand that a major source of opposition to the original nuclear deal came from Persian Gulf monarchies,
mm-hmm.
and that they cannot assume that they can that these countries may be weak militarily facing Iran in the region, but they're pretty powerful in Washington, and that's also a great source of strength for them.
And we should probably add Israel here to the mix. What do you think?
Well, I would put Israel differently because Israel is not talking to Iran. But at least this, but you're right. I mean, in terms of Washington, definitely. But at least the Iranians don't want Persian Gulf monarchies to be big voices against a nuclear deal with Iran.
Right.
At the same time, the Iranians are resisting including regional issues in JCPOA. But one way of wanting to reduce this issue altogether is by telling the United States, Congress, et cetera, that we're solving the regional issue on our own.
Mm.
So it's not like regional issue is not being addressed just because it's not part of JCPOA. It's being addressed. And I think on the Saudi side, you know, Saudi Arabia sort of has realized that the United States is leading the region. It did not defend it when the Abu Ghraib attacks happened. The Saudis got too close to the Trump administration and perhaps don't feel quite the same confidence that they would have with a Democratic administration. And I think issues like the Khashoggi issue damage Saudi Arabia very seriously. Mm. And therefore, they don't have quite the same position they had in 2015 to 2020 in Washington. And also, there is now a very strong Democratic opposition to the war in Yemen. And that's a pressure that is working on the Biden administration as well. So I think the idea of not talking to Iran at all, which is no longer makes sense to them. And it's not just Iran. They're also started talking to Turkey. And so the Saudis are realizing that, you know, when the United States was the two-ton gorilla in the region, they could afford to take this sort of boycott kind of a position. We're not going to talk to Ankara. We're not going to talk to Iran. And now they need to sort of reduce tensions with those capitals themselves. They've started this conversation, and I'm sure they're talking behind the scenes with Israel. So Saudis basically are hedging their bets in multiple directions.
Mm.
But one other issue is that the United States also, for the first time, is encouraging the Saudis to have these talks. Like, the United States was supportive of the Baghdad Forum.
Mm.
And in fact, encouraged Arab leaders, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, etc., to attend and to make it a success. And even a U.S. ambassador also attended it. This is very different tune from the Trump administration.
Are you saying in a way, sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to for more clarification on this point because it's fascinating. So are you saying that the pivot to Asia or less U.S. Engagement in the Middle East might actually lead to some cooperation between the middle powers in the region?
Yes, I think so. Mm. I think that's, part of the problem in the Middle East. It's the only region of the world that has no security mechanisms or forums in which all countries are involved, whether they like each other or not. Arab League is only for Arabs. GCC was only for Arabs, right? There is no forum that has the Turks, Israelis, Iranians, or at least some of them in the same forum.
True.
So it's, you go to Africa, you have Organization of African Union. In Southeast Asia, you have ASEAN. So, but Middle East does not have such a thing. So the United States basically occupied a sort of a huge amount of diplomatic, military, security space in the Middle East. It was in alliance with Turkey and Israel and with also a lot of the Arab governments. And then those who are not, like Iraq and Syria don't exist anymore. Now the United States is leading. It's in the United States' interest, as well as in the region's interest, to begin to think about, building multilateral structures that would allow them to take joint ownership of regional security. Of course, we're a far distance from that. Even GCC went in a wrong direction after the Qatar boycott. I mean, in a way, GCC really doesn't exist anymore. Oh, it's only a name. After what happened with Qatar. So there is definitely a need for that. Now, it's Iran and Israel are not talking, but that might come at a later stage. That's a bridge too far right now. But I think if Iran and Saudi Arabia arrive at a point where they agree to some kind of a security arrangement in the Persian Gulf area, maybe some maritime security arrangement, maybe some kinds of understandings over their own bilateral relations. And then, you add other Arab countries to it, et cetera. Then you would gradually sort of build from that to have some kind of regional forum that would fit into this. But, there was once when Taif agreement happened between Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iran outside the room contributing. It ended the civil war in Lebanon. Now, the outcome is not ideal. They didn't rebuild Lebanon into something other than, the communal situation that led to the civil war, but it did end the war. So is it possible at some point that Iran, Saudi Arabia, others can have an agreement on Lebanon again, on Iraq, on Yemen? Now,
great,
that's
point.
An ideal, but it has to start with Iran and Saudi Arabia actually getting to a point where they have embassies, actually having one or two small security agreements as a basis. Mm. And then you go, you build on that, build on that. So it's a long process. But I think the current conversation is the start.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, this is my focus. My doctoral thesis is on regional cooperation, drawing some lessons from the ASEAN, from Latin America, and the African Union to see how the region can build some sort of cooperation.
Wonderful.
In the shadow of the pivot to Asia. Unfortunately, our time is up today. I want to finish with a question to help the audience know you better and also to help the audience know the Middle East better. You spent your childhood in the region. Would you share with us something you like about the region, whether that's a novel, a piece of music or a song, a place, a dish, probably anything that you would like to end this episode with?
Well, that's very difficult because, you know, you gave an open-ended question. Yeah. There are too many things that I like about the region. I mean, but what I like about the region is obviously all of the above. It's its culture, it's food, it's the relationship between the people. But I want to say that, you know, at level of high politics, you know, there is tension between the people of the region, but at the level of people themselves, you know, there is a sense of shared history and shared taste and shared set of social, personal, human values that connects them above and beyond the language.
Right.
So a Turk inherently understands an Iranian, an Arab, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a wonderful cultural basis on top of which to build something more interactive and permanent in the region.
Right. And you know, that's why I picked Siyasa as a name for the podcast, because it's also understood in Arabic, Persian, and Turkish. Siyasa or Siyaset.
That's right.
I totally agree. There is a lot in common between all the cultures in the Middle East.
That's right.
Professor Nasser, thank you very much for sharing with us your analysis and insights.
Thank you.
And looking forward to having you again on the podcast to listen to your thoughts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening to the first episode of Siyasa. The podcast is available on Apple and Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spotify. It's hosted on peacefair.net, the website of Professor Daniel Sewer. I'm Ibrahim Alassil, and I hope you enjoyed this episode.